You are listening to the Everything Financial Radio podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. If you're a new listener, welcome. This is where we talk about what's going on in the economy and the finance markets, and we look at things from a perspective that your history teacher would be proud of. Winston Churchill said, "Those who want to understand the future must look deeply into the past." It's a profound statement and sage advice, and that's what we try to do here each week on the program. I'm interviewing a couple of guest experts this week. Joining me on today's program, William Engdahl, the author of The Lost Hegemon, as well as Lawrence Reed, who is the president of the Foundation for Economic Education. Both gentlemen are returning guests, and they're returning guests for a reason. They always bring a lot to the table. And I caught up with them both this past week and caught up with them and got their perspectives on an updated basis. If you would like to become a subscriber to my Portfolio Watch newsletter, it's easy to subscribe. All you need to do is visit the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. That's your, Y-O-U-R, portfoliowatch.com. Once you become a subscriber by giving us your name and email address, every Monday at 5, you will get the latest issue of Portfolio Watch. Again, the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm very pleased to be speaking once again with returning guest to the Everything Financial Radio program, F. William Engdahl. Mr. Engdahl is the author of the book, The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy. You can learn more about his work or get his book by visiting his website, WilliamEngdahl.com, and Engdahl is spelled E-N-G-D-A-H-L, so that's WilliamEngdahl.com. And William, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you again, Dennis.
William, let's start with the title of your book, The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy. Now, it's my take that there are people listening to this that don't know the meaning of the word hegemon, so explain the title.
Okay. It's a word originally, I believe, from the Greek that means the dominant power. A century ago, it was the British Empire. The sun never sets on the British Empire. And today, since 1945, it's been unquestioned, the United States of America. And the lost hegemon, the reason for the title, and if you go to my website or to Amazon.com and look up the book, you'll see a very dramatic title. The words, the lost hegemon, are almost unreadable. They're faded gray on a white background. And then off to the right is a very, very tattered American flag. And the flag was reportedly uncovered or recovered from the rubble of the World Trade Center September 11th, 2001. And Whom the Gods Would Destroy, it's the idea that the American, I don't want to call them elites because they certainly aren't elite in my book, but the powers behind the scene who buy presidents and sell them, who buy political parties, who control Congress and so forth, the David Rockefellers, the George Soroses, the Warren Buffetts, what will you, that they, and people far wealthier and more discreet than they are, they are losing power everywhere, and they're becoming desperate about it. So the whole war on terrorism was an attempt to create a new enemy image by Bush and Cheney back in 2001 to replace the fact that the collapse of communism left them without a boogeyman to whip up sentiment and justify huge defense budget expenditures for the taxpayers. And so what they have developed in a hyper way is what was on the back burner going back to the 1950s when the CIA in Munich first began to work with something called the Muslim Brotherhood that had been working with the Nazis in the Third Reich during Hitler's era, to go against the Bolsheviks or the Red Army, the Soviets in Eastern Europe. And they picked up this franchise in Berlin. Then they got to know them in Egypt and brought them when they were outlawed for trying to assassinate Nasser in the 50s. They smuggled them into Saudi Arabia, where they made a fusion with the ultra-conservative medieval Wahhabism brand of Sufi Islam that the Saudis practice. It's suitable to a desert Bedouin culture, if you can imagine what that is in the 1700s, and still is today. And that fusion created this radical ultra-Islam ideology with a political aggressiveness that wanted to recruit through jihad all over the world. And, of course, Saudi oil money financed that with the tacit agreement. As long as you guys, the Muslim Brotherhood, do that outside Saudi Arabia, we'll be glad to finance your madrasas and your mosques and whatever, which is how it worked. So the book is really about that obscene marriage between Washington, U.S. intelligence, State Department, the whole kit and caboodle, and radical Islam, to weaponize Islam in this way that created Al-Qaeda, back through Osama bin Laden, who was a Saudi, run, handpicked by the head of Saudi intelligence, who resigned only very recently. And it traces back into the radical Islamic groups in Chechnya that were smuggled out of the Afghanistan theater by the CIA into Azerbaijan and then into Russia, into Chechnya and Dagestan in the Russian Federation after the 1990s. Then into Bosnia for the Yugoslav breakup by the U.S. or by the CIA. And from there, it's gone into Syria, it's gone into Iraq, it's gone into Libya, virtually every Arabic state, Muslim state of the oil-rich Middle East. And that is, in short, the chronicle of the book. It's a unique story. It's one, I think, that bears very, very careful reading in this day when this theme is really upending the entire world right now.
Well, William, we've got maybe 3 minutes left in this segment, and you made a comment in your explanation that the powers behind this scene, and you'd mentioned a number of families, you mentioned George Soros, and then you said there's those that are far more discreet and far wealthier. But, you know, when you look at just some headlines that are hitting today, George Soros, I think, just gave the Hillary Clinton campaign $6 million. So to what extent is this prevalent? I mean, when you look at the average American that gets so caught up in politics, are all the politicians really kind of getting their money out of the same pockets?
I would say, to answer you briefly, yes. There was a transition between Bush, Cheney, and Barack Obama, who was the president elected on one word, change. And all they changed was the face, because Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, the military-industrial complex, they just shifted their money to back Barack Obama because the country was fed up with the snarling Dick Cheney and his wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that were killing American youth and not winning anything for the United States or for the American people. So they brought in Obama to simply continue the same thing. There was a study by my alma mater, Princeton University, 2 years ago, analyzing legislation that had been passed by Congress since the 1980s, since 1980, I believe. And they came to the conclusion that de facto America has become an oligarchy, where a tiny handful of ultra-influential, ultra-rich people control Washington politics. And that really is the case. It's done through corporations. It's done through the banks of Wall Street, not normal banks, but the seven or eight hyperbanks of Wall Street that ought to have been nationalized in 2007 and broken up, and their administration brought to trial like they did in Iceland, and put on the dock and sent to prison for their crimes because there were criminal activities going on, still are.
Well, we're chatting today with William Engdahl. His book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy. His website is williamengdahl.com. I would encourage you to check it out. I will continue my conversation with Mr. Engdahl when Everything Financial Radio returns. I always appreciate the perspective of Mr. William Engdahl. I'd encourage you to check out his book, The Lost Hegemon. It offers some great perspective, and I'll get back to my conversation with him right now. I'm chatting today with William Engdahl. Mr. Engdahl is the author of The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy. The book is available on Amazon. You can also get it at his website, williamengdahl.com. That's E-N-G-D-A-H-L, williamengdahl.com. And William, you had made a comment in our first segment that I want to go and circle back and have you comment on. You'd mentioned that since the 1950s, so this is shortly after World War II, the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States, has had a partnership with the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, given what we hear today about the political proposals, if you will, to ban Muslims by one candidate, I mean, we're hearing a lot about this. It's going to be hard for a lot of listeners to believe that that's actually a fact. Could you expand on that?
What happened, the Muslim Brotherhood, give a thumbnail history sketch here. The Muslim Brothers were created in 1928 in Egypt by a small-town school teacher, Hassan al-Banna, and became a worldwide death cult, literally death cult. I have quotes from al-Banna in the book that explain that. But it had two faces, very much like the Fethullah Gulen movement in Turkey today that was behind the failed coup d'etat against Erdogan 10 days ago. The Muslim Brotherhood had a public face, which was charity, good works, service to the community, and they had a private arm, which was building power networks through all means necessary, much like the Jesuit order in the 1600s, 1700s, some say up to the present. And they had a assassins bureau that would eliminate key people that stood in their way for power. And in the 50s, well, during the war, the Brotherhood was driven out of Egypt the leadership was driven out of Egypt by the British and ended up in Berlin, where they headed up the Arab language broadcast of the Third Reich, of Hitler's Third Reich, and worked intimately with Heinrich Himmler, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was a leading Muslim brother, was in Berlin for the duration of the war, broadcasting, and he actually, in certain instances, advocated a more severe policy for extermination of the Jews than Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS himself, and that's, I have documented in the book. The brothers, this charming secret society, then, when they were outlawed in Egypt because they tried to assassinate the president of Egypt, Nasser, they were brought by Miles Copeland, the CIA station chief at that time in Cairo. They were smuggled out of Egypt and into Saudi Arabia, where they formed this fusion with ultra-conservative Wahhabism, as I mentioned. So the Muslim Brotherhood, they are the chosen instrument of Hillary Clinton's State Department when she was Secretary of State, and no doubt will become again if she tries that foolish gambit. But that's why the U.S. backed Mohammed Morsi, the Muslim brother who became president briefly of Egypt and was deposed in a military coup d'etat. It was a coup d'etat. Much against the wishes of Washington. So Mohammed Morsi was in the process of introducing Sharia, destroying the secular constitution of Egypt. And by the way, the timing of that Arab Spring coup against Mubarak was very interesting. It came out in Hillary's emails to Sid Blumenthal, her friend and advisor, who had business interests in Egypt and Libya. And apparently Libya, Egypt, and Tunisia were on the verge of creating an Islamic bank based not on the petrodollar, not on the U.S. dollar, but on gold dinars. Get your arms around that one, because that would have brought a tectonic shock to the world's dollar system had that gone through. And that's the main reason those three were targeted for elimination, and all three of them are gone today from the so-called Arab Spring democracy movement, which is had nothing to do with democracy. It was a State Department, CIA series of coups.
Well, certainly, when you look at the economic impact of a gold standard that existed somewhere in the world, I mean, that would completely knock the U.S. dollar off its petrodollar perch. I mean, it would be revolutionary, and yet it seems that that movement around the globe is intensifying, looking for alternatives to the U.S. dollar. Do you want to comment on that, William?
Very much. One of my recent books is dealing with exactly that thing in terms of the China One Belt, One Road, the new economic Silk Road project, where China is consciously, in cooperation with the Russian Federation, building its high-speed rail links close to where known gold reserves exist in Central Asia, but have no infrastructure to bring it to the market. And China is accumulating gold. It's the world's number one gold producer, by the way. South Africa is down to number seven. And number two in the last accounting that was done in the London Bullion Market Association, number two was Russia, the Russian Federation. And both of them are determined to exit the dollar dependency, the dollar system. So both of them are accumulating gold in significant amounts, and I think what we're seeing is two nations with the clout to pull it off. You can't do a Gaddafi, coup d'etat like Hillary Clinton did against Gaddafi in Libya. You can't do that to Vladimir Putin. They tried, certainly. God knows they tried many times. And you can't do it against Xi Jinping, the president of China, or the leadership of China. So they've tried color revolutions in Tibet. They've tried the color revolutions in Hong Kong. It all goes like water off the duck's back, because finally the Chinese have figured out that it's National Endowment for Democracy, U.S. State Department, color revolutions, and they call it by name. And once they did that in the Hong Kong case, within 24 hours, the protest stopped. They were caught with their hand in the cookie jar.
What a fascinating...
So I think the gold, to come back to your question on gold, I think the emergence of a gold monetary order is unstoppable at this point. And that's what has people in the U.S. Treasury, people in the Federal Reserve. The U.S., I just completed a piece for my blog on the corporate debt of the U.S. and the delinquency rates that are soaring right now up to Lehman Brothers levels of September 2008. The United States, that's why another reason to call it the lost hegemon. The gangsters who run Wall Street have looted the country of everything viable. They've destroyed all the healthy jobs that used to be for Americans as engineers, as scientists, researchers, as whatever, and those they outsourced to Asia, to South America, and whatnot, and leave the United States as a hollowed-out shell with no infrastructure. It's a catastrophe. And this is thanks to people like George Soros. This is thanks to people like David Rockefeller or Warren Buffett and so forth. Such people... We don't need to have in such positions. Their assets should be taxed to oblivion and the returns used to rebuild America's infrastructure.
Well, fascinating conversation today with Mr. William Engdahl. His website is williamengdahl.com. William, always enjoy our conversations. Would love to have you back.
I'd love to be back then.
Well, special thanks to William Engdahl for joining me on this week's podcast. Also, as I mentioned at the outset, I did catch up this past week with Mr. Larry Reed, and I'll get to my conversation with him right now. I'm pleased to welcome as a returning guest to the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Lawrence Reed. Larry is president of the Foundation for Economic Education. Their website is fee.org. It's a great organization. Please check them out. He also has a new book coming out in September titled Real Heroes. It is available for pre-order now. You can go to fee.org and do that. And Larry, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Dennis. It's always a pleasure.
Let's start, Larry, by talking about your new book, Real Heroes. Let the listeners know what it's all about.
Okay, I'm quite excited about it. It's coming out in late September, but it can be pre-ordered now at fee.org. It's called Real Heroes, Inspiring True Stories of Courage, Character, and Conviction. And it's got 40 chapters. Every chapter is about a different person that I regard as a hero. And many of them readers will not have heard of before. I deliberately chose people who are not among the big names of history, but nonetheless are heroic in so many ways. And I just hope the readers will find the book very inspirational.
Well, I will look forward to reading it, and you can count on my pre-orders. So,
thank you.
Larry, today, talk a bit about an article you wrote titled The Entrepreneur as Voyager. Now, it's a great article. It's longer than we have time to probably in our two segments today talk all about, but give the listeners a premise, if you will, of the article.
Okay. I used the story of Joshua Slocum to make a larger point. Slocum was the first person in the history of the world to sail around the Earth entirely by himself. Now, a lot of people would say, if you asked them who was the first to circumnavigate the globe, they'd say Magellan. But he had 237 men and five ships. Joshua Slocum did it in about 3 years' time, starting in 1898, or 95, rather. And he was by himself the entire voyage, 46,000 miles. The larger point I was using his story to make is this, that entrepreneurs are very much like voyagers. A lot of people, unfortunately, think of an entrepreneur maybe as somebody who's just motivated by greed. He just wants to make money, and he has no loftier objectives than that. But I think the vast majority of entrepreneurs are like Joshua Slocum. They're in it for the joy of the adventure, for the notion of creating things, solving problems, building a team. And so I think their achievements and their motivations are often understated, and we should look at them as entrepreneurs as we do people like Joshua Slocum. They're real voyagers and real heroes.
You know, Larry, it's interesting because in my lifetime, I remember growing up, and everyone looked up to someone that had their own business and worked hard and was successful. That was the American dream, after all. And now it seems that a lot of times success as an entrepreneur is vilified. What happened?
Well, I think the progressive agenda of the last century has really worked its way into academia especially, and then that spilled over into the media and into politics. And the progressive philosophy and agenda really looks down upon achievers like entrepreneurs. In fact, progressives tend to think of entrepreneurs as people who are excessively self-interested and they're driven by greed. And whereas if we look to government, then those are the folks within government who kind of have everybody in mind and they're thinking of all of us, and they represent the the people of the country and so forth. They ascribe to government such lofty motives that I just think it doesn't make sense. But I think that's where a lot of this is coming from. The entrepreneur is an independent-minded person whose success doesn't depend upon the government. And so people who worship government don't like that. They like people to be dependent upon them.
Larry, where's the disconnect with those that have that mindset? Because I often joke that I'm a libertarian capitalist. I'm a big supporter of entrepreneurs, and there's maybe not many of us left on the planet, but I stand up proudly and say that's what I am. Where does this disconnect come from? I mean, government cannot exist without successful entrepreneurs.
Yeah, and yet you hear people like Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and Barack Obama, the president, saying things like, you didn't build that, or nobody succeeded entirely on his own. The government did something for him. And they never acknowledge that quite frequently entrepreneurs have to overcome obstacles that government puts in front of them. And not everybody is an entrepreneur. Lots of people are perfectly happy to sit back and reap the benefits that others had to take a risk to create. So the entrepreneur is a very special person. But if you are of the mind that government is the source of wisdom and wealth, then you're not going to be very friendly to those who actually create it, which is what the entrepreneur does.
You know, Larry, when you look at the environment today, it's becoming more difficult for entrepreneurs to be able to succeed in business. And my own personal observation is that just jumping through all the compliance hoops with all the government agencies and regulatory agencies that exist is becoming more difficult. And of course, the cynical side of me says, is this something that, you know, big businesses are lobbying for to eliminate competition? Because unless you have a team of lawyers and maybe a team of accountants, it's becoming more difficult to succeed as an entrepreneur.
It sure is. As a matter of fact, there are a lot of ways to measure this, but just coincidentally, I was working today on an article about the Democratic Party platform of recent decades, and it's kind of a measure of the massive growth of government. Do you know that in 1892, the Democratic platform only had 2,500 words, but the last platform in 2012 had 26,000 words to it? Well, that's reflected in everything government does these days, the massive amount of regulations that nobody can keep up with, the tax code that's incomprehensible to most mortals, and to the endless responsibilities that people have foisted upon government. It does so much now, at the federal level especially. It does so many things that what it's supposed to do, you have to wonder, is it really doing it well anymore? It just has too many things to keep an eye on.
Well, when you look at the current election year, you look at the current crop of politicians and those that aspire to lead us, are you seeing that this trend toward making it more difficult for entrepreneurs to succeed, is it going to get tougher moving ahead, or do you think that there may be some relief in sight?
Well, you hear talk of relief in sight. Certainly Mr. Trump says that he's going to do some of that, but at the same time he also talks about telling business people that they can't go to Mexico or without a penalty, or they can't do this or that. So I'm not too optimistic that that he would fix this problem. He's also talking about not touching entitlements, but that's where most federal spending is. So if you don't fix the entitlement problem, which is massive and threatening to bankrupt the country, it's only a matter of time before small businesses and ordinary Americans are going to pay an awful price for this massive expansion of government. Nobody really seems in Washington these days willing to fix the fundamentals that ultimately can benefit us in terms of small business creation and job formation. They're just piling responsibilities for government on top of another.
Well, our guest today is Mr. Larry Reed. Larry is the president of the Foundation for Economic Education. He's got a new book that you can pre-order titled Real Heroes. It'll be out in September, and you can get more information at fee.org, which is the website of the Foundation for Economic Education. I would encourage you to check it out. I will continue my conversation with Larry Reed when Everything Financial Radio returns.
Give me your money. Money.
you're getting something out of the conversation I had this past week with Mr. Larry Reed, and I'm going to get back to the conversation I had with him. I'm chatting today with Larry Reed. Larry is president of the Foundation for Economic Education. Their website is fee.org. It is an extremely worthy organization. I would encourage you to check out their work. You can also pre-order Larry's book that will be released in September of this year at fee.org. The name of the book is Real Heroes, and I would encourage you to check it out. Larry, you know, we talked in the last segment about this article that you wrote paralleling the story of Joshua Slocum with entrepreneurship. So for those that might not be familiar with the story of Joshua Slocum, let's start there in this segment.
Okay. Well, first of all, I should recommend the book that Slocum himself wrote about his voyage. He wrote it, and it was published in 1900. It became a bestseller, and to this day, it's regarded as a kind of classic of travel literature. And the title of it is Sailing Alone Around the World. So it's a very entertaining read. But this guy, at age 51 in 1895, left port on the east coast of the United States, intending to sail east. He was going to cross the Atlantic, enter the Mediterranean at the Rock of Gibraltar, and then ultimately go through the Red Sea and then down into the Indian Ocean and around the world in that direction. But when he got to Gibraltar, right across the Atlantic, he was chased by pirates. And like any good entrepreneur, he's very flexible, and he just decides the best way to evade the pirates is to change directions, and instead of going around the world to the east, he heads west, over to South America, and then down ultimately around Cape Horn at the southern tip of South America, and then across the Pacific. But his book is full of adventures along the way, and one of my favorites is he was warned at some places in Brazil where he stopped that when he got down to the tip of South America, he might have problems with some hostile natives down there who would attempt to board his boat and kill him and take what he had if they had the chance. So he had a small arsenal with him, but the most effective thing that he had was a barrel of carpet tacks, which he picked up in Brazil. And when he got down to the tip of South America, each night he would cover the deck with those carpet tacks, knowing that the hostile natives down there did not wear shoes. And lo and behold, one night about 1 a.m. in the morning, he woke up to howls of pain from these natives who had boarded the boat but quickly left when they stepped on the tacks. So little stories like that show that this guy was quite resourceful.
And, you know, to go back and tie that into the entrepreneurial comparison, it's interesting, but I work with a lot of entrepreneurs in my practice, and one thing they all have in common is that not only are they hard workers, they are increasingly more resourceful because they have to be.
Yeah, oh, they're facing challenges from the government all the time, and of course global competition. And so a good entrepreneur these days probably has to be even more resourceful than entrepreneurs of the past, just to escape the landmines the government's put in his way.
So getting back to the story of Joshua Slocum, he went around the globe, sailing around the globe by himself, the first man to do this. How long did it take him?
It took him 3 years and 1 month, just about a month longer than it took Magellan way back in the 16th century. But he did it in a little 36-foot sloop, sailboat, and entirely by himself, which is an amazing thing for a man in his early 50s.
So let's go back and talk a bit about your organization, Larry, FEE.org. For the listeners that might not be familiar with what it is that your organization does, we've got some time left. Let's talk about the work of FEE.
Okay. FEE is an educational organization. We don't seek, nor would we ever accept, funding from any level of government. We're funded entirely through contributions. And for the last 70 years, we've been educating young people in particular, on ideas of individual liberty, private property, limited government, and personal character. And in recent years, we've exploded in terms of our growth and impact. We're reaching now about 1 million readers every month at fee.org. Our in-person seminars with students from all over the world and other campus and school presentations are reaching more than 20,000 students in person every year. And our very vibrant website, fee.org, has a tremendous and growing following.
So, Larry, what's the mindset of those that you work with? I think you had mentioned before you work largely with those, say, age 18 to mid-20s. Is entrepreneurship starting to be held in higher esteem with this age group?
I think among those younger people, yes, it is. And certainly we see it at our seminars. Now, I admit that those who come to our programs may be a little bit friendly towards entrepreneurship in the first place, but even those who may not be, it's not hard to get them excited about it. The very notion of being independent, creating wealth, building a solid team, achieving something, inventing something new, or using technology to achieve great things, young people tend to find that exciting. They're idealists by nature, and they love a challenge. And so we enjoy encouraging that because we think it's vital to preserve both our freedoms and our economy.
So, Larry, to what extent do you think today's rather sluggish economy is contributing toward maybe a resurgence in an interest in becoming an entrepreneur?
Well, the sluggish economy may be actually working in the opposite direction because unless you are very highly motivated, which you become when you come to one of our seminars, you might be a little bit depressed because you see so many obstacles in your way that are making the economy sluggish. But the moment you really are encouraging to a young person who wants to be entrepreneurial, I think they tend to overcome that. But you've got to get them excited and say, look, in spite of those obstacles that you face, you can make a difference. And the world is waiting for you to solve a problem and meet a need and satisfy a consumer demand. And if you do that and do it well, you'll not only fix a lot of problems in the world, but you'll be very satisfied yourself. It's one of the most fulfilling things you can do in your life.
So, keeping with the topic of our conversation today, which is entrepreneurship, are you seeing any particular area of opportunity or areas of opportunity for those that are thinking about jumping in and becoming an entrepreneur?
Well, I think in those areas that deploy technology and cutting-edge technology, there are boundless opportunities. And that's the area that I think more than any other tends to be most interesting to young people. They're really excited about science and technology and how those things can be used to create remarkable new products and services. And I think the opportunities in that area are just limitless. And now with the Internet so widespread, the costs of starting such businesses sometimes being far lower than they would have been just a few years ago, I think the opportunities there are just huge. The problems we'll be solving in coming years, if we preserve our freedoms through technology, will I think, amaze everybody.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Lawrence Reed. He is the president of the Foundation for Economic Education. His book, to be released in September, is titled Real Heroes. You can get more information at fee.org. And Larry, thanks for joining us. Love to have you back.
Hey, anytime. Thank you very much, Dennis.
Well, that concludes the podcast for this week. Certainly hope you got something you can use. On next week's program, joining me will be Mr. Alistair McLeod. He is a brilliant economic researcher, and I caught up with him this past week, and we'll be airing that interview next week. I talked to Alistair about what he sees are looming signs of hyperinflation, and more importantly, what you might think about doing now in your own personal financial situation to protect yourself. Talk to you again next week. Bye.